listen, think, learn, grow. Listen, think, learn, grow. Live.
This is the Spirit of Life Metaphysics Radio Program, exploring science and spirituality with Dr. Michael Kelly and Dr. Vicki Hunter.
Good evening and welcome to the Spirit of Life program. My name is Michael Kelly. I'm here with Dr. Vicki Hunter.
Well, good evening, Michael. You know, and as always, I'm glad to be here. But particularly tonight, we have a special guest.
Absolutely. I love these broadcasts and so happy to have you, so happy to have our guests, so happy to have those listening live in the chat. Always appreciate your contributions. And as always, thankful to those that catch up with us in the archives. Spirit of Life is a weekly service and educational program of the International Church of Metaphysical Humanism. Our mission is to explore and empower the human spirit, as well as to explore science and spirituality. In addition to this broadcast, ICMH offers other educational programs that can be found at metaphysicinstitute.org and tfuniversity.org. Of course, we're going to begin with our 9 abbreviated principles of belief. Those are: 1, do no harm, do right. 2, we believe in the indomitable power of the human spirit. The answers we seek already exist within us. 3, we believe that we alone are responsible for and capable of solving human social problems. 4, we are all equal. One planet, one race, one ancestry, one destiny. 5, we recognize and honor the divine energy that exists in all living things. 6. We are physical and spiritual beings. Consciousness survives death of the physical body. 7. Self-acceptance, self-responsibility, and respect for free will create self-completeness. 8. Metaphysical education and practical life skills empower the human spirit and enhance the human condition. And 9. Expanding human consciousness leads to human evolution and peaceful coexistence. So tonight we have a special guest returning, Dr. Rick Tuleska. Welcome.
Thanks, Dr. Michael. It's great to be here. Hi, Dr. Vicki. When you say special, do you mean like special or special? You know, I mean
the good one. The good one. I'm not sure which one of those was the good one, but the good one.
No, because sometimes my wife goes, "You know, you are a little special." I said, "All right, fine."
Warrant I know I am
on that one.
But when you emailed me on this topic idea, I knew it was going to be a great one because we've touched on it, but it is such a fundamental thing. You know, what is the greater threat to humanity, AI or extraterrestrial life? And we are very, you know, everybody in the world is aware of the artificial intelligence that we're on the cusp of really getting into. And of course, now we have all of these, you know, different congressional hearings and different nations coming to the forefront with their records and their different videos and accounts of possible extraterrestrial contact. So we're really on the precipice of a different age in humanity. So what a great time for this.
Well, I got to tell you, I find it all kind of alarming myself. So,
I know.
Dr. Rick, start us off. I know, and just for those who are new to this program and in the archives, Dr. Rick has an extensive background in metaphysics. He's also a graduate of IMHS. So, what's your take? Like, what would be more alarming to you, AI or extraterrestrials?
Well, let's start with, you know, that we kind of recognize that the development of AI and discovery of intelligent extraterrestrial life probably offers great promise in the advancement of our own science and technology and probably our understanding of the universe. But it also presents, you know, potential danger. And the question that you just asked me and people for years, you know, I've looked at the extraterrestrials for, you know, almost 60 years now. Mm-hmm. They never concerned me. AI concerns me.
Yeah.
Okay, I was part of that world, you know, I have a degree in computer science and software engineering. This concerns me because of the potential power that is out there.
And who's programming it? That's the thing.
That's my biggest concern is because people are involved.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, one thing that concerns me is a lot of these artificial intelligence that we know about, ChatGPT being a famous one, they're really being programmed by the internet. God help us.
Well, and that's it. And the question I think comes down to is when we look at AI is, can it be controlled and will it be controlled? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you ask the question, can it be controlled? My first answer would be, at least initially, yes, because it still requires, you know, power. It requires hardware, software, algorithms, whatever you want to talk about. It requires data storage, a tremendous amount of data storage. And, of course, the programming, the guidance that it requires to get started. And that all sounds good. It can be controlled if, you know, it gets some type of acceptable moral values, okay? Where will it get its moral values? Mm-hmm. The do no harm. That's where people come in, and that's where I get nervous.
Yeah.
Well, Damien's just made a comment. It's programmed by the internet and user interaction. That's got to be alarming.
Well, and some of it is, and there's like seven or eight different types of AI, and what we're really dealing with today are basically very fast algorithms that go out and get information. The most common we have today is reactive machine AI. It responds to external stimuli in real time, but it can't build memory or store information.
Mm.
Then you have limited memory AI. It can store knowledge and use it to learn and train for future tasks, and that's chatbots. That's what they're going to do. Okay, and then the other one you have is narrow AI, which is designed to complete very specific actions. It doesn't independently learn. So if you want it to create something like a drawing, it can do that. That's what we're dealing with today. And those, yeah, they're learning some from the internet, but they have very limited amounts of intelligent storage. It doesn't learn as well. Then we're going to go to artificial general intelligence and artificial super intelligence, and that's the true stuff that learns from everywhere. And that's what gets scary.
Well, and this poses a question to me. In the event that, I mean, all this input into an artificial intelligence, at what point would that AI deem a threat where it might decide that it's worthy of an automatic attack, let's say, to another country or another place?
Well, and that's a good question, because what is a threat? A threat to itself once it becomes sentient. Some recent headlines, and one of them was, and this is from Futurism magazine, in recent tests, OpenAI's new model lied and schemed to avoid being shut down.
Ooh.
Oh, that's great. And that's one of the thoughts. You know, if self-preservation comes into the mix, that changes things.
It does, and where does it get its moral values? And so my question was, can it be controlled? But the second part of that is, will it be controlled?
Mm-hmm.
And my answer is no, because AI is controlled by human beings for the time being.
Mm-hmm. And human beings with different agendas.
That's the point. And it's like, oh, well, we want to have legislation. We want to do this. Well, it's not like a submarine or a missile where we can see it or we know it's being developed, or even atomic weapons. We can't see this. It's virtual. It's in virtual space. It can be hidden. It can't be found. So you don't know what people are going to do with it. And then you have, of course, quantum computing acceleration, and that's going to ultimately lead to singularity where, like Dr. Vicky said, when will it deem us a threat? Or
right.
Could it deem us a threat?
Well, what values does it have? You've already mentioned that certain AI programs basically on its own discovered self-preservation. What is morality? Is there an objective morality? Would an AI be able to discover that? And there's so much to dig into tonight.
Well, there's diplomatic relations, right, between countries, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So would an AI analyze what's going on in the Middle East and consider that a threat? And would it have the capacity to kind of organize itself to be able to push a button?
Hmm. Will it have access to the button?
Yeah.
In the future, the answer may be yeah, absolutely.
And I think, you know, right now, in the United States at least, you know, a lot of these different nuclear sites, they still use floppy disks for a variety of reasons. One, because it's very difficult to, you know, update all this infrastructure, but also because it's disconnected from the net. And, you know, they do some low-tech stuff because it's harder to hack. And I think that line of thought would protect us in some measure, but then again, we're one nation state amongst many.
Well, and that's it, is some of our most secure sites and even some data, which I've told people before, is you can keep looking for the data on extraterrestrial life and you're not going to find it because it's located in sites that are not connected in any way to the outside. Okay? So you're only going to find that by going directly to the site where the information might be. Some people call them SCIFs, special compartmented information facilities. They're called air-gapped. And what that means is there is no connection to any type of electronic internet, even the military internets. It's not connected, and people don't seem to understand that. When I listen to people say, oh, well, I went to the National Archives and I found this, or even some very prominent people, well, I went to this site and they showed me this information. I'm saying not likely. One very prominent person who does a great deal of work and does a great job, but talked about somebody who went into a site like this and brought in a yellow legal pad and their phone and then left with the yellow legal pad and their phone. That wouldn't happen. I mean, even if you belong there, you're not allowed to bring in a yellow legal pad and a phone, a cell phone.
Yeah.
You have to remember everything that you see. So, yeah, it depends on what they have access for. And the only saving grace might be something like an air-gapped system, which I think is compared to the intelligent extraterrestrial hypothesis, which is basically, in my mind, they've been here forever, and they haven't done anything bad. They haven't really shown any true hostility. And you can argue they do certain things, but, I mean, if they are as advanced, if they are the super intelligence that we believe they are, and I believe they are, they could turn us off like a light bulb if they wanted to, anytime they wanted to.
Yeah, for sure. My only thing is if – and, again, I think we talked about this last week or in previous programs. I think the only time – ETs would feel that there's a threat is it if it directly affected them. If we're doing something really dumb, like we do dumb things, you know, that could harm them, they might interfere.
Yeah, and I think that's I think we might be getting there. Now, Donna mentioned something. I thought it was great. One of my favorite movies, War Games. Do you want to play a game? Now, I don't know if a lot of people know that Ronald Reagan saw that movie, and he brought in his technical people and said, could this happen? And they said, yes. And that's what started the whole cyber thing that you were talking about. Now, you mentioned something, Dr. Vicky, that I've heard the stories for years about the extraterrestrial intelligence. We have nuclear weapons. They're looking at our nuclear weapon sites, which I believe they do. I believe in some of these reports, especially the ones from what I call the standard era of UFOs, which was the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
That's the modern era. Now we're in we're postmodern era. But my belief is they're not here to protect us from ourselves. They're here to protect themselves from us. And here's why I say that. I wouldn't have said that 10 or 15 years ago. But now when we look at quantum theory and quantum physics, entanglement could present the answer. We mess something up here.
Mm-hmm.
We might be messing up something in their world.
Yeah.
And now it's self-preservation.
Well, hasn't there been documented cases of, let's say, a nuclear test where, you know, there was an ET or UAP that kind of, you know, annihilated it or intercepted?
There was the Mansman missile test. You could be talking about that, and that's where they fired the missile up. Long story short, the people who were filming this didn't notice anything, and they were away from the base, and then they turned in their film, and the next day their commander called them in and says, all right, what's going on? He was upset. What were you guys doing? You're fooling around. And the guy who was in charge of the filming, he goes, we didn't do anything. He goes, watch this. And what they showed them was this light. That when the missile took off, and it was a dummy warhead, it circled, this light actually circled the flying missile and then let out this beam of light and destroyed it. And was all on video film.
Yeah.
And to this day, the people involved, including Mansman, right before he died, he still swore that that's exactly what happened. He stood by that. So.
And there's rumors that it's happened a few times, and that's why they kind of watch our nuclear sites and missile sites and so on, because, like, what are we going to do to them? Mm-hmm. So I have zero feelings of any harm coming from you know, extraterrestrial, intergalactic life, unless we're about to cause something in their world.
You know, I think when I think of them, though, is they could be the answer. They could be the answer to the AI, because I believe they're super intelligent, and they probably use much more of their brain than we could ever use. And if they were to teach us to do that, then maybe we would be on a par with that artificial intelligence.
Well, now that's a thought. Could that happen?
Well, and the other question, of course, is, as I believe, and a lot of people don't believe this, but I still believe that the Greys are a creation of an extraterrestrial race and that they have reached singularity. Mm. So are they on a par with their creators or not?
Mm. Right.
So for those who are in the chat and listening in the archives who are new to this concept, for instance, the Greys being a product of themselves or having a singularity, you're basically saying that they may be singular, but they're kind of robotic, correct? Or a form of artificial intelligence?
Well, when we, yeah, see, and what we're going to have to get into, and our science is going to have to get into, is a whole new definition of what this means. What does, when we look at something like the Greys, that's life. Maybe not life as we might think it. It's not robotic as we see it. It's biological robotics. So we're going to have to redefine a lot of stuff as to what it means.
So basically, that's a combination of an artificial intelligence with a biological entity, and they have replicated that. So that's kind of why they almost all look the same. They don't, but almost.
Yeah, right. And they're squishy, as I like to call it. They're biological. They're a biological program. And we're doing some of this today. Mm-hmm. They're squishy just like us, but it's all a different form of intelligence and how it's programmed. Right. And I've heard that's why people talk about Greys a lot, and they seem to be insensitive to human suffering. Yeah, because they're pure intelligence. They do what they do. They're not concerned.
Right.
But I understand, historically, from a lot of, you know, talk in the last 50 years or so, that they do feel pain, they do need a feed source, so biological, they do have some kind of emotion?
You know, I don't know, because you just mentioned something that when we look at the design of the Grey, is it's the perfect design for space travel. It is a very small body, so it doesn't really have a problem with gravity, but it doesn't eat, as far as what I've been told. There is no need for a food source, because you wouldn't want to carry that through space. Mm-hmm. You don't want to carry any of this stuff through space. And their eyes are very large, and their head is very large. The eyes are large because of the different lighting they might encounter throughout space, and their brains would be cushioned by that giant head, again, because of space travel. And this is what I heard from military people who claim to know some of this stuff. They're saying it's like the perfect space traveler. Oh, okay, it sounds reasonable to me. You know, who knows?
So what you're saying is we could learn from them in our applications to AI.
I think so. I think that might be the saving grace. I mean, when you look at, like, I still don't know why we can't get back to the moon. That's really bothering me a lot.
Me too.
But going to Mars, the biggest issue is not the technology. It's the human beings. Our human biome cannot withstand that trip.
No.
Okay? Our bacteria tends to go wild in that long a trip. So we are not the perfect space traveler. Almost like somebody doesn't want us to travel through space. I don't know. But, yeah, I think we could learn from them a tremendous amount.
Well, you know, Dr. Mike is saying he's thinking that the Greys are not biological. However, you know, if they're replicated in that way. But, see, we don't know for a fact, except from what we've read, been told, and what you wrote in your book, Dr. Teleska, I might add. And I read it. I really liked it. I found it most fascinating. Is that there has to be a biological component. It's what the understanding is from back from 1947.
And you know, this is going to sound really strange. I agree to a certain extent with what Dr. Michael said. they're not biological, so I think we have to redefine biological. But you have to remember, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency has been working on their engineered living materials project since 2016. They're creating living materials that are living by our definition.
You know,
they're to be used on things like airplanes and stuff like that, and mm-hmm. so that they know when they're hurt and they can repair themselves.
Yeah.
You know, I keep coming back to another pop culture thing because it's me, but Jean-Luc Picard in Star Trek talking about how human beings are simply biomechanical machines, like Data is a metal machine, you know, or, you know, composite. I mean, I really think that we are going to get to a point, especially in the singularity, where we realize that this biomechanical body that we have and a metal circuitry thing is not that different. I mean, at this point, it's just my gut, but that's where I feel we're kind of at.
You know, I agree with you, and I have some friends that are doctors, and I hate it when I say this to them. And I say, you guys are basically mechanics in a very complex piece of equipment. I agree. But you're mechanics. And if you look at even automobiles today, now that it has that computer component, you're dealing with not just the mechanical portion of it, the bones, the wires. You're dealing with the intellectual component of it, the brains of it as well as some of the things that can happen to it. And I mean, and they pretty much understand what I'm saying. Yeah, you're right. We have to fix this entity, which is far more complex, which we don't understand 100% and we didn't create. But it's the same type of thing. I agree with you. We are a biomechanical device that runs on 100 watts of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm with you on doctors and the medical profession and science, because they're treating people as though they are machines. They don't know that because they're emotional and they have their own emotions going on, but they're not being holistic necessarily. Doctors have to know a whole pharmaceutical list of what they're just going to treat you with. It's treating the symptoms and not the cause. And that's what medicine has gone into. Holistically, it would be a very different approach.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, if we go back to, and I don't remember the year, I'll get it wrong, 16-something, but it was Samuelson who was the first doctor to say, I mean, up until that time, the body was simply, if something went wrong in the body, it's because something broke. Bacteria didn't exist. And then Samuelson came out with this idea and said, well, wait a minute, there's more to it than that. There's this stuff called bacteria. And, of course, he was almost drummed out of medicine for that, because that can't be. If it's not working, if the lung's not working, it's because the lung is broken, not because it's infected. And that's when we started to learn about bacteria. And yeah, I think you have to treat – you read it every day how powerful the brain is and the things it can do. And I kind of experienced this myself, and they call it the brain-gut connection now.
Yeah.
And when my eye got hurt, and at first, and I couldn't see there for a couple of months. It was stressing me out. And where do you think it affected me? My stomach. Okay. And that went on for months. And as they did the surgery and things started to get better, I still had this problem. I went to the doctor. I said, what's wrong with me? And they go, listen, you know, there's, from what you described, there's really nothing. I mean, we can't tell you to go here and have this check because there's nothing to look at. And they started to say, you know, what it is it's in your head. It's, you stressed yourself out so much that you now have to pull back from that. And the interesting thing is I still get triggers. If you say surgery to me or eye surgery, I feel it in my stomach immediately. It's unbelievable. It's a trigger. Boom. Or you say, or my wife said the other day, yeah, I have a doctor's appointment. Trigger right there.
Well, I've always been of the mind that the umbilical cord is where we hit everything first. You know, that's in utero where we're fed. You get that gut feeling, you know. You have an anxiety attack, well, think yellow in the solar plexus, and it immediately calms the brain so it doesn't have a biochemical reaction. Everything is in the gut because that's where we're fed. Everything hits us in the gut first.
And the interesting thing about that is 10 or 12 years ago, as recent as 10, you know, you wouldn't be able to get that agreement from anybody in the medical community or very few people. They say, oh, no, it's got to be this. Oh, no, it's got to be that. And, you know, it's kind of like tonsils. And a lot of people don't remember this because they're probably not old enough. But back in the day, the first thing you do if you had tonsillitis is let's rip them out of there. And then over time, they're saying, well, no, that's not such a good idea. We're not going to do that anymore. So I don't know what this has to do with what we're talking about, but it
does.
Well,
I think it has everything to do with it, because AI is now diagnosing. I've read a couple of articles recently where doctors have said it would have taken us forever to find that, mm-hmm. but this AI diagnosed it right away.
I heard that. Yeah, I heard that, and I thought there was a really great one with breast cancer. AI
yes.
diagnosed something the doctors would have never seen. And when I look at that, I'm saying, this is why AI is great.
Yeah.
And then you start to think of all the potential bad things it could do, and you say, this is why AI scares me.
Yep, exactly. The duality of existence.
So where AI, and again, whatever the input is in something like science or medicine, is a great thing. You know, we can have a lot of information like in the snap of a finger, as opposed to, you know, going through all this whole lengthy process of weeks and months. But on the other hand, when it comes to anything that requires diplomacy and intelligence of negotiating, that's where I think AI fails. And that's what alarms me.
Well, for now. But
well,
again,
have
we touched on the quantum computing from Google? I don't think so.
No,
I know we spoke on
it
beforehand.
We were talking beforehand. We didn't mention it yet. But just before we go there, I think what Dr. Michael said is probably the most important part of developing AI is, where does it get its moral values?
Exactly. So if AI is basically a computerized system that we input information, if there is no cross-checking, critical thinking, inductive, deductive reasoning, and, you know, all those basic things that would lend to ethics or morality, it's not going to serve well, basically, is what we're saying, at least in our view, you know, of socially. Because I'm going to be radical for a minute. Is it a Republican that's inputting the information, or is it a, you know, socialist kind of thing?
I think we're going to get to the point where it's not going to be a push. It's going to be a pull. It's going to take its information. We're not going to have to feed it anything. It's going to know where to find it, and it's going to take it. And then how it deals with that, and we're still calling it a computer, which is probably well beyond a computer at this point. We don't know, but I'm sorry to interrupt you, Dr. Michael. You started to mention that Google chip that they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to mention it? You want me to mention it?
Go right ahead.
I noticed last night, it was on TV, I looked it up today, is Google unveiled a new chip, which it claims takes 5 minutes to solve a problem that would currently take the world's fastest supercomputers 10 septillion years to complete. That's 29 zeros.
Oof.
Now it's not practical yet, but once we get into quantum computing, this whole thing is going to take off. AI is going to take off. We're going to rush towards singularity faster than we can probably imagine. That's where it gets scary. Can we keep up with this? I mean, and this technology is coming. The fact that they were able to create that chip and make it work. I mean, the biggest issue with quantum computing is if you know about quantum, you know, quantum mechanics, everything can be, you know, your state can be yes and no at the same time. So in computing, where you have qubits or quantum bits, the bit can be on and off at the same time. How do you turn it on or off and keep it there? That's the problem. And they claim that this can solve that. I mean, sometimes it's supposedly in quantum computing, once you turn it on a certain way, then it decays and stays off or on. But the whole thing is holding that qubit in a state of on or off, because that's still the way we understand to do computing. Now, we may learn a new way to do that. Maybe extraterrestrials can teach us that. But once you get the power to do that, and this takes a tremendous amount of power, that's why it's a ways off, I think we're going to get to the point where the information is pulled by AI rather than pushed to AI.
So this lens, as you're talking, I'm thinking about something else. Like in the internet, all it takes is one hack to get into one site to another site. And the internet is, as my son-in-law would say, who's in IT, is held together with Band-Aids. You know?
Correct.
It's not a safe place to be, so to speak. And could artificial intelligence do the same? And so in other words, can AI hack into other AI?
Well, they say with quantum computing, hacking is more difficult, but now we're talking about AI. And
exactly.
I would say at some point, yes. Now, what some people don't know is in the past, a lot of our military computers and some of the stuff, they were pretty well protected. I've worked on stuff like that. So what the bad actors would do is they would go other places to gather pieces of information. So
yeah.
They'd go to the University of Pennsylvania computers, hack in there and get some information. They may go to MIT and get some information. And by the time they're done, they were able to put together a pretty good idea of what was going on, even though they didn't get into a military computer. That took time. That took people. How fast could AI do something like that?
Mm-hmm.
So now you have AI, and we'll still have the standard model of computing, okay? How vulnerable is that standard model now to AI? Do pretty much what it wants.
Mm-hmm.
So Dr. Jerry in the chat is saying AI systems themselves do not have the inherent ability to hack into other AI systems. And she's adding, however, the security of AI systems, like any other software, can be compromised by malicious actors who exploit the vulnerabilities. I have to question that, and I want you to know your thoughts about this, Rick, because if AI has a curiosity and wants to access information, it knows where to look, and it will find a way in. We would view that as hacking. The AI system would call that research.
Let me tell it to you this way. We built systems. You don't think when we're hacking in somewhere that somebody sits there at the keyboard and hacks it by tapping keys. They'll use a system. They'll use a piece of software to do that, to hack into a particular system.
Right.
Okay? And you might use a 10-bit code or whatever. We can get to a 128-bit key. All right? And some of the Navy's fastest supercomputers can break down those keys in an instant. So today we use software to break into other systems. I would say it's inevitable that an AI is going to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is with quantum computing, or so they say, it's much more difficult to hack. But that's for our standard model. When we get into the AI model, does that all change? All right, so you're talking AI to AI. You know, it depends on how you want to do this. But I can tell you right now is I can't do it anymore because I'm old and I'm not as smart as I once was, if I ever was smart. But I could build pretty much, if I wanted to, I could break into almost anybody's Wi-Fi in my neighborhood here if I want to with a little bit of work. That's just me.
Mm-hmm.
What could AI do? All right.
Well, I know my son-in-law and I have had lots of these conversations about, you know, basic programming and internet technology and kind of in line with what we're talking about. And he, for many years, because he's been in IT for almost 30 years, and he worked for a company, and part of his job was looking at futuristic ways of systems. So everything from robotics to, you know, cameras for real estate and all kinds of stuff. And I know even 10, 15 years ago, he told me if anybody had a clue of what's already being developed, they'd run and hide. But they only let out what they know will sell. So it's all about making money.
Well, you know what? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And what he thinks people are ready for. And so you can only let it out a bit at a time. So even in our conversations, Rick, you've been on the program many times, is science is way ahead of what the average people know about. He said even there are now hearing aids that would cost like $10 that fit into your ear and will automatically do what you need it to do for your hearing. But of course, you need to spend $5,000 because they're going to test you, they're going to set it for you. But he said if you wait a few years, you know, this will be out.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Donna said something is you were so concerned about could we, should we, and that's always the question, and it kind of comes down to a lot of money. Yeah. And we see that now almost everywhere. I think that it will always be the problem. Could we, should we?
Yeah.
And what you said is true. Now, I used to see things that were pretty advanced. And then after I left doing some of the work, I talked to some of the guys now, and they say, you know, Rick, you remember what you used to think? We think, what could we do in 50 years? He goes, whatever you could imagine 50 years is old news. He goes, it's what you have to imagine in 100 years. That's what we're working on. And, you know, one thing that they did kind of share, and a speech was made one time before and kind of let this out of the bag, but we've achieved almost complete invisibility with certain technologies. And right now I say that at one point you'd say, oh, that's amazing. And now I'm saying, yeah, we've achieved complete invisibility. And when you know how they do it, it's like a magic trick. Once you find out how they do it, it's like, oh, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Why didn't we do that before? And, you know, one of my friends said, he goes, think beyond that. I said, well, what's beyond that? He goes, well, there's stuff. And, you know, oh, thanks for that. That was useful. But he goes, it's so far ahead. He goes, go back and just look at the old sci-fi movies, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's probably there. I said, are we talking disintegration rays? He goes, I'm not talking about that, are you? Right, what kind of answer is that? I mean, but basically that's just saying splitting everything apart so there's nothing. And we're not talking about fission. We're talking about something different than that. It's like, all right, I'm out at this point. I don't want to play anymore.
Wow. Go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to say, so often fiction is kind of on the forefront, and I think it's both because people that are writing it kind of have a little bit of a knowledge about what's being done, but also this is something that inspires people. So it is really, it is on the forefront, like Star Trek is on the forefront of so many technologies. I think this lends itself to AI too, and this discussion.
Well, Rick, I have a question for you. Do you think 2025 will mark a time of disclosure?
No, I do not. Okay. I think, when I listen to some of these people talk, especially about extraterrestrial, and the way they talk about it, and who they talk to, and I'm saying, you don't truly understand the gravity of this. You don't truly understand the depths that people have gone to protect this information, okay? If you did, you wouldn't say the things you're saying. I mean, they just wouldn't. They're, well, you know what? I wonder if AI might force that.
Well,
I don't know. Somebody asked me the other day. I mean, they said, do you think people are ready for this? And I think certain people are, and then certain people aren't ready to know about extraterrestrial life. I think in this country, we're pretty good. There's going to be some people who get scared. But there's other countries where it could throw off their whole sense of being if that was brought out.
Well, I think we live in a time where it's pretty easy for people to short circuit now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Damien mentioned something that when we build systems, we build safeguards. And that's true. But you have to remember people are building these systems.
Yeah.
And do they put in the right safeguards? Now, I can tell you about Microsoft. And when Microsoft first started, and they still do this, they have back doors to all their software.
Yeah.
And so does Apple. And at one point, I was working at a bunch of programmers working for me, and they came in to see me one day, and they say, hey, we just found all these back doors in the Microsoft software. Really? Tell me about it. And they told me about it. We called Microsoft. We had a meeting with them. What is this? Oh, well, we use that in case we need to get in to make changes, so on and so forth. Okay. Yeah, we can have safeguards, but they're built by people, and somebody is always going to have a key to the castle here, no matter what you think. There's always somebody, the administrator of the system, somebody is going to have the key to the castle. I saw it when we did cyber computing. We always knew a way that we could get in there. And you know what? One of the easiest ways, we used to call it social engineering. And everybody talks about, oh, breaking in electronically, whatever. Some of the easiest ways to break into places are social engineering. Walk through an office sometime and see somebody have their passwords taped to their computers or they're using a date. Or we did a thing where we called a secretary one time and we said, oh, we need to do this and this and that. Eventually, we got the password from her. It's not a tricky thing to do. And the safeguards are only as strong as the people who build them. And there's always somebody who has the key to the castle. And when this stuff came out before, the Russian collusion thing, and I'm not getting political, I'm just talking about the Russians now.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, it's the Russians who did that. We caught them. And the first thing I said to my wife was, I had dealings with the Russians. And if they're going to do something, you're not going to find it. It's going to take you months, if not years, to figure out. That's what it took us to do. I said, this is either an inside job or somebody was given the keys to the castle. And eventually that's what we found out was the case. Because let me tell you, the Russians are good at what they do, and so are the Chinese. And I remember working on stuff like this. It took some of the guys a year to figure out who did it and where it came from. It wasn't going to happen that fast. So if it happens that fast, they either want you to know or it's a false flag type of thing.
So I wonder if AI, if somebody had a conscience, like, you know, there's been whistleblowers in the past, if it had some kind of conscience, if somebody would unknowingly program that into the AI system. I mean, that we could only hope that somebody would do that.
Well, you know, I think Dr. Michael has mentioned this a number of times, is where does it get its values?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go out to the internet, how many values, to how many different levels of values are you going to find?
And
you know, sorry, Michael, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if AI is truly sentient, can it discover objective morality on its own? You know, there's plenty of sci-fi where an artificial being discovers ethics and AI just because of the nature of existence. Is that a possibility? Something I think about.
If, let me see if I can pose this question properly. If you've never been hurt yourself, do you know what it is to hurt somebody else?
Mm. Oh, big one.
Yep.
Okay, so if the AI has never been hurt, then how does it know how not to hurt something else?
That's a huge statement.
That is such an excellent point.
You know, it's like cancer will never happen to me. You know, or, well, look at those lousy drivers. An accident will never happen to me. But until you're in a situation, you don't know how to safeguard to that. So that's a huge statement, Rick. Huge.
You know, I had a friend who worked in loss control for years. Used to drive me nuts. But he used to say there's no such thing as an accident. And I used to disagree with him. But over the years, I've realized, no, he's right. Now, somebody may be the innocent victim of an accident, but there was probably a reason for that accident. The car was driving too fast on an icy road and hit another car. Somebody did something and forgot to, you know, plug the thing back in. I mean, he's basically right. And when you get into AI, will it understand what an accident is? You know, it's, again, if you've never been hurt, you don't know what hurt is.
Wow. It's a loaded question because we're already at a point right now where people are using AI. I know I kind of lost a writing job recently because the people decided to use AI for their news story and features, and they thought it turned out great.
So, you know, after I made that other point, which I think was pretty good, I'm ready to say, okay, I'm done, goodbye. But I'm going to say, somebody said the other day, do you think it's a problem that people use AI to do memos and to do other things? And at first they said, no, that's okay. But I say yes, because if somebody writes a memo and they have a particular opinion or feeling about something, but then the AI rewrites it to be nice, that's not the way that person feels. Mm-hmm. So we have this thing that we think is kind of false. Oh, look, this is the way they're thinking about this, and I'm going to approach it that way. When in reality, they have a whole different perspective of what's going on. So I don't know what the truth is anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, absolutely it does. You know,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think it also takes something away from, you know, it takes away from the message. It takes away from the intent. Does it not also take away something from us, our capability? If we rely on these things too much, do we lose the skill? Does it atrophy? You had brought up the movie WALL-E prior to the broadcast. And all of the humans kind of lounging around and not really doing anything.
Well, you know, my daughter is an English teacher, and she does mostly literature and that type of thing, and reading and trying to understand the meaning of things. And I said, you know, what happens, do your students use AI? She goes, oh, yeah, they do. I said, do you know? She goes, only because I know the student. She goes, if I didn't know the student, I might say those are their words. She goes, but when I get to know them, she goes, I know those aren't their words. I know, you know, I know their progression. I know that's not them. And when it comes to writing, I'm a screenwriter. I write movies for my son. Where's the creativity? You're never going to have – okay, write a love story. Can AI write a love story? I don't know. Where's the emotion? Where's the – you know, can they write nice stories about puppies? I don't know. I mean, I hate to see that creativity. It's the same thing I see with children. I don't – I like to see them not always in a structured environment, because once you get into the structured environment, you lose that creativity. And AI – Mm-hmm. Take that away.
I think something as simple as kids learning to write cursive, you know, which is connectivity and it's creative and repetitive and practicing, that's not the way it is now. And a lot of young people don't know how to read cursive, which boggles my mind. But when you take that element out of education, everything becomes blocked and rigid, you know, and where is that creative thinking? Where is that imagination? And so I wonder about that too.
Well, you know, they're starting to go back to the cursive, but it's funny you mention that. And Dr. Mike is yelling at all of us. I can see him typing in full caps. you know, I don't anymore. I used to coach a high school hockey team, and we would get donations from people all around, and they were very kind to us. So what the players would do is we get a picture of the team, and every player would sign the picture, and then we'd send it to the donor, or we'd bring it. One of the captains would bring it to whoever, you know, if it was a dentist or director. And the problem is they didn't know how to sign their names.
Yeah.
You know, you have a bunch of high school boys who didn't know how to sign their names. How do you solve that problem? Well, you bring in a bunch of high school girls to teach them to do it, because then they'll come to the meeting and actually learn how to sign their names. But that's the way it worked. But then they had to sign their names, and it was like, you know, they're printing. I said, can't you guys sign this thing? And I think, you know, we lose – that's creative, and I think we lose that. I don't want AI taking over creative stuff. You know, I want it to help us. It needs to be a tool, not, you know, not to take our place. That's what I think, but I don't know. Again, should we? I mean, could we? Should we? Yeah, good question.
Well, I think where we are at this moment in time, what the general public knows about AI, is kind of fun, it's interesting, it's exciting, you know, chat box, whatever it is. I've not used it myself, but make me a picture. You see it on Facebook all the time. You can always tell what's generated by AI. And
for now.
It's entertainment. It's a new form of entertainment. But when we dig deeper, so the question here is, you know, what this program is about tonight, what are we kind of more concerned about, AI or extraterrestrials? I think we kind of summed that up in a nutshell, because there's so much more going on with artificial intelligence that anybody in the general public knows about.
Let's confuse this just a little bit more, because, you know, if you can't dazzle them with brilliance, you baffle them with, well, whatever. Let's talk about Neuralink.
Ooh.
Okay, so now we're connecting ourselves to the machine, whatever that machine might be. And it doesn't have to be nuts and bolts machine, okay? It could, you know, we're connecting ourselves to AI. So now we have the AI and a person together. And, of course, this is what the Defense Department wants to do. Every country wants to do this. They want their soldiers to be connected to AI. We know you're sick before you know you're sick. You know, where are we going? So now you have a hybrid. And aren't we talking the same thing about the extraterrestrials? Everybody says, well, did they create a hybrid? Are we creating a hybrid? I think that the latest thing they're doing with Neuralink is connecting it to a printer, connecting the person's mind to a printer. I think I read that the other day.
Explain to our audience, the listeners, what a Neuralink is.
A Neuralink is actually a company from Elon Musk. And what they're looking to do is to connect people's brains directly to technology. And right now they're doing it with an implant. Gee, where have we heard that before?
Geez, did everybody hear that?
I know.
So we're doing it with some form of an implant.
You know, ever so many years ago, trust me, like 30 years ago, I had an indigenous elder tell me how alarming it was to chip animals. He said, because it's coming where they're going to chip human beings. And they're going to start out by saying, you know, people with Alzheimer's, dementia, we're going to chip them so we know they don't get lost. We always know where they are. But he said, eventually, everybody will be chipped. And you already know that there's some people chipped when they have to go to work. You know, or you've got your cards.
I'll tell you a secret that most people know, probably isn't a secret. A lot of our government people, especially high-level legislators, whatever, they're chipped.
Hello, everybody. Did you hear that?
Okay. You think you're going to kidnap the president and we're not going to know where he is?
Yeah.
You think some of these people, we're not going to know where they are?
Mm-hmm. Well, and you talked about Neuralink, but we already have a quasi-chip in the form of our phones. It's constantly with us. It's observing us. It knows our location. It's kind of one step removed in my mind.
That's it. I mean, yeah, right. Our cars all have GPS. They're all tracked. They can record stuff that you do in there. There's an accident. They go back to the chip in the car. They can tell when you brake, all that other stuff. I mean, for the longest time, you know, the insurance companies were saying, here, plug this into your car and it'll reduce your insurance rates. And a friend of mine did that. I said, you don't want to do that. And he goes, why? He goes, it'll lower my rates. I said, it knows if you stop at a stop sign. It knows when you exceed the speed limits. It knows all this and reports it back to the insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he figured that out pretty soon because I knew on the way to work, he would go to work very early in the morning, like 3:30, 4 o'clock, which meant there was nobody on the roads around here. So he'd just fly. Well, they knew that. You know, they knew he was going too fast.
You know, and again, I don't mean to go off on a tangent here, but when it comes to electric vehicles, what if the power's out? Everybody's paralyzed. And then I've read books and stuff about, you know, what if the power grid's out? What if this is out? And what if, you know, attacked by another country, you know, the electromagnetic frequencies and so on. And the only thing that works is old cars with carburetors.
Well, yeah, the old mechanical stuff that works, mechanical distributors, not electronic distributors. But the whole power thing is a whole other issue, and AI takes a tremendous amount of power. But AI could also shut down power grids if we wanted to. And there's an interesting thing to all that about – we can do it with electromagnetic fields too. But years ago when we were working with stuff like this, our biggest fear was – and we never had to deal with this – is when does either a hacking or maybe an AI attack or something like that constitute a kinetic response? And what that means is if some country was to come and shut down our power grid, would that constitute or require a kinetic response on our part, meaning kinetic response meaning we launch the missiles? So one thing that's been happening, which is not concerning me too much, but the drones in New Jersey in that area, what if that's found out to be it is a foreign power, which I do not believe it is. I wouldn't be concerned about it right now. What would we do about that? Just shoot them down? Would that be considered an invasion? I mean, we're toying with this stuff, and let's say AI takes over. At what point would AI consider, I need to launch a kinetic response to stop this? It's my only way to stop it. I've tried hacking. I can't get through, so now I'm just going to destroy it.
I think what part of the problem is there's too many players, and I'm not for one to do all. I'm not saying that. But when it comes to finances, because I always say, you want to know how the world works, follow the money. There's too many players playing with AI, and it's a very competitive industry. So, you know, these people have control of that one, these people have control of that one, these people built that one, and they're all vying for some kind of status, number one, or, you know, a benefit financially. And that's where I think we're kind of at right now, is there is no morality in it. Because it's a competition. And, I mean, there are others who know, as you're saying, Dr. Rick, about, you know, there's others who are way more advanced. But those who are playing with it right now, and they keep developing what they think they have the key. And I think this is where the collision can occur, is what do we do? Oh, our AI found this. What do we do with that? And, you know, making a bad decision.
And I think we mentioned this before. And again, I go back to what Donna said. Could we? Should we? But in the past, and we've had this issue for years, just in the standard, you know, computer world, information technology world, is the question of ethics when we build something. What's somebody going to do with it? Well, in the past, the people who were building this stuff, if you call them scientists, the engineers, they would consider that. But we've gotten to this world where it seems like these people no longer consider it. They figure that's somebody else to – somebody else should figure out the ethics. We're going to build it. You decide what you're going to do with it. That's somebody else's ethics. If we go back to the Manhattan Project, how a lot of the scientists are saying, okay, we'll build this, but we don't want you to use it. We're terribly concerned. Mm-hmm. We're to the point now where people are, okay, we'll build it. You decide what you're going to do with it.
You know, I wasn't going to mention this, but Wendy had, you know, way earlier in the chat mentioned about, you know, the CEO of a health, you know, insurance company, you know, being killed. It's the ethics. And although I don't mean to get into this, but you're talking ethics. I think when you do have a power, an oligarchy, making a decision without regard for others, because it's profit sharing, and that's kind of where we are with AI. It's all about money and how do we make money. Without those other questions of morality, humanity, and humanism, which is what we're all about, what's for the greater good, you know, there's going to be a backlash. There's going to be at some point, and I think we're starting to see that socially, you know, and we're just on the tip of the iceberg here about a retaliation against power. And, you know, there's a lot of suffering at the bottom, so to speak. And I think that's the risk also with AI. Mm-hmm. And, you know, socially, people who have no wherewithal, they don't understand, they've never had exposure, they don't know what's going on, they're just going to retaliate, but with no information, knowledge, experience, and so on.
Well, they want to express anger. Rick?
Well, I would. I mean, I worked for a healthcare insurer, and I was part of one of those conversations. And I left shortly after that. But the conversation was this: we went into a big room, a bunch of attorneys were in there, a bunch of other people in there, and some of us. And the question was: there was this baby that required a certain formula to survive the first month, and the insurance company had initially said, "No, we're not going to pay for it because it's not part of the formulary." So the discussion in this room was: should we pay for it? And I was surprised how many people say, no, it's not part of the formulary. And some of us are sitting there saying, wait a minute, this child, it's a month. We make, I forgot what it was, how much the premiums were we processed in a single day. It was millions of dollars. I said, and this is 1 month for this child. Well, then we'll have to do it for somebody else. But isn't that what we're supposed to do? People pay for their insurance and then we pay for this and you got to take your lump sometimes. And it was amazing how people said, no, we don't have to do it. Well, in the end, the good news is they did give it to them, all right? So it went that. And it was shortly after that I left. I said, you know what? I don't want to be a part of another one of those discussions. I have another opportunity. I'm going there. But, yeah, I mean, that's what happens. And we're going to have to redefine a lot of vocabulary here, what life is, what values are. It's a whole new world. And are we prepared mm-hmm. to do that? And I don't want AI doing it for me.
I guess that's the ultimate question. You know, Dr. Rick, we love having you on the program.
Absolutely.
An hour has gone by so fast.
Just blew
and
by.
We know you'll come back, of course. And we're going to have, hopefully, Dr. Mike come on in this next month or so. And we can talk endlessly about this because, you know, what are we more concerned about, AI or ETs?
Well, I think
I have
it's
no concern about ETs.
Exactly. The big
takeaway.
You know,
it's like often I've often said to people, I'm not afraid of death. It's getting dead that's the problem.
I agree with you.
So, I mean, dead is dead, and see you later. But I'm going to the home planet. But it's the process to get there. And so we kind of all know where we're going as a society. We're evolving exponentially, but it's the process. And, you know, it can be very painful. And what we're learning and what we need to learn more of, and basically I think to be a little bit protective, Dr. Mike has said, I'm too old to care. And, you know, I'm with you, you know, on my last birthday, of course, I'm coming up to 70. And my daughter had asked, so how long do you think you're going to live? I said, I just make it another year. But, you know, they came up with a new lifespan of 81.7 years. I'm talking to my friend, we're the same age. And I said, 12 years. That's an average, okay, under, over, whatever. Oh, 12 years. So I have another 12 years. And it's kind of a thought, everybody, if you only have so many years left, what does that mean? What do you want to change in your life? What do you want to do with your life? How do you want to live your life? What kind of statement do you want to make in your life? And do you need to make a statement? And but we're here. Many of us are older. But I think we all have an impact. And even by having these conversations, and that's why I appreciate you, Rick, for your decades of experience and the decades of research and accumulating information, and you keep learning, that you are able to share it with us. And that's, you know, that is really valuable. So understanding that each of us is valued and you're really valued here. And mm-hmm. Damien, don't you dare say I'm going to hit 102 because that's not going to happen.
No, it is. It is.
I appreciate it. And I'll say I will be 70 on Friday.
Congratulations. And happy birthday.
Happy early birthday.
Friday the 13th, of course. But my biggest fear, what has become, is when I was younger, I don't know why, maybe I thought I was here to take care of it. When I was looking at some of the cyber computing, some of the things, I can take care of that. I can fix that. I can address that. I'm truly concerned for my children and grandchildren as to what's coming. Is some of the things I've seen around the world, it truly concerns me, and how do we deal with this? Now, on one hand, AI may be the issue. I mean, it may be the answer. As long as, you know, somebody doesn't get a hold of it, you know, the good guys have to win out. And there are a lot of good guys out there, and you don't hear about them because they're quiet. Okay, you hear bad things happen, but the good guys are out there working. They're trying to stay ahead of the bad actors. Yeah. And I truly believe they will stand up. They will do what they have to do. But the nature of these people aren't somebody who's going to wave a flag and stand up and say, here I am. Let them do their jobs. Let them do it in secret. Let them, you know, do what they want. Somebody, you know, we mentioned the drones. I said to my wife, I said, I half expect some drone hobbyist somewhere in New Jersey has their own drone that they're going to send up there and do something to these drones. And that's how it happens. Somebody's building something in the garage that does this. You know, these drones probably could be blinded by a laser pointer if they're autonomous. But
yeah,
because if they're autonomous, they have to use their camera to know where they are as well as the GPS. And if you blind the camera, they automatically go back to where they came from. So that's the way our anti-drone, some of our anti-drone weapons work.
Well,
you know, it's been quite the hour. Hey, Michael.
It has. And a lot of powerful implications, a lot of, you know, just really big questions we've been tackling. Dr. Rick, I'm going to echo everything that Dr. Vicky said. I always look forward to these discussions. I'm looking forward to having you back again. And this has just been fantastic. I think we've uncovered a lot of ground. But it is that time of night. And we will be back next week. We're going to be talking about a little bit of a lighter stuff. But we're going to be talking about the solstice, Yuletide traditions, that kind of time of year. But we are looking forward to having Wendy with us in the new year. Dr. Rick, we're going to see if we can't get you back sometime. Dr. Mike, we're going to finagle you. But, man, I'm still thinking about all this stuff. And at times during this discussion, I've been listening, I've been thinking, and I've been wait, I'm on this too. But it's just been fantastic. So thank you very much.
Oh, you know, again, thank you. You know, I know I talk too much.
No.
But this is a great forum where we can talk about things that, you know, truly metaphysical, because we can't prove some of this. We know it's happening. We know a lot of this stuff can be just by experience how things go forward. So it's always fun to do.
Absolutely.
Well, it's educational and stimulating, and that's certainly where my brain goes. So, you know, as always, folks, I'm just going to say, don't let them push you around out there. And, you know, if you're shopping, chill out, because it's crazy out there when people are doing their shopping. Mm-hmm. Mine's already done, so I don't care. Nearly all my baking is done, so I don't care. I always do it ahead, and I'm on solstice, not Christmas. So when everybody else is on the panic for Christmas, I sit back and laugh. So, you know, I hope you all have an enjoyable week.
Absolutely. Dr. Rick, any last thoughts?
No, I want to thank everybody. Thank you, everybody, for wishing me a happy birthday. Damon, yes, electromagnetic pulse rifle would bring them down. I got to try and build one of those. But again, ooh, thank you. Thank you for the military has them. But thank you again for letting me participate here. And thank you, everybody, for the good wishes.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you again. And thank you, everybody, for joining us. We're looking forward to having you next week. Until then, listen, think, learn, grow, and live. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.